Welcome to season 3 of Conversations with Coaches. This is a stakeholder-centered coaching production where we believe everyone deserves a stakeholder-centered leader. I'm Brandon Murgard, your host for the show. This season, we go deep into the case study library to discuss the real-life challenges of leaders and the coaches who help them succeed. As an added bonus, we're giving away the latest installment of our case study library, which includes case study summaries, show notes from each episode, and ways you can connect with the guest. Get your copy today at mgscc.net/case-studies. Today, we are delighted to have JB Adams, a seasoned coach known for his innovative approach to leadership development through group coaching. JB shares his journey working with a public sector client, preparing for a new generation of leaders to step into the role of retiring executives. Join us as we explore how JB's unique coaching methods, deeply rooted in trust and stakeholder engagement, have paved the way for lasting leadership success. Come on in and let's find out more about the client.
So this particular client is a public sector client. Essentially, they work for the government and they serve the community. And at the time that they contacted me, they had, a stable of mature leaders in executive level roles. And they knew that these leaders were going to be set to retire in the coming years. And so they approached me and they said, we need to train the next generation of leaders, and we would like you to do it, and you can do them together as a group. So the first cohort that they gave me was 6 leaders together. And these were all people working in management, 3 men and 3 women. And the primary problem was just that. We need to prepare the next generation of leaders. But I also recognized a second problem. And that was based on my previous experience with coaching. Individual coaching, when you are the person being coached, that can be a lonely endeavor. And the reason that I, you know, put it into those terms is you're going through this experience, you're getting feedback from your stakeholders. Sometimes it's bad news. Sometimes it hurts your feelings. Sometimes you feel like I have to figure out how to make this change, and it's very uncomfortable. And you're going through this experience alone. Now, as your coach, I'm there to help you through it, and I'm there to express my belief that you can. But it can help to go through it together with someone who really understands what you're going through. So group coaching was the solution to 2 problems. Problem number 1, prepare the next generation of leaders and get our succession planning underway. And problem number 2, addressing the lonely endeavor so that they can go through this together and support each other by virtue of the fact that when you go through adversity with other people who are going through the same adversity at the same time as you, you bond with those people because you get to the end, like, we made it, we survived this adverse moment and came out better and stronger, but we also relied on each other as we went through it. So that was really the 2 problems that needed to be solved with group coaching.
When they reached out to you for the first time, how did they find you? How did they know that you existed and offered coaching services?
I have a great network of friends and colleagues in the community. And I always give this advice. If you're an introvert, make friends with an extrovert. So extroverts are a great way to keep your network alive. And I am very naturally an introvert, but I'm friends with a lot of great extroverts. So one of my professors, was very well connected in the community, serves on several boards. He was initially contacted because he's the nucleus of many networks because he knows so many people. And so they said, do you know somebody who can come and provide coaching to our next generation of leaders? And he's like, oh yeah, I know somebody. And he called me up and he actually went to the first meeting with me. And as we were leaving, he said, you write the proposal, it's yours. So those are the kinds of colleagues that you want to have.
Oh, that's amazing. Yes. And I wholeheartedly agree. I absolutely love being the hype man for my introverted counterparts. It's such a joy.
And, you know, tell me about these leaders. So we've got six leaders who need coaching. Was this a voluntold situation? Was this something they were eager to do since it was going to help them move up in the ranks?
Well, I'm glad you posed the question in that way. They are getting coaching, but it wasn't necessarily something that they had requested. So I encounter this regularly with stakeholder-centered coaching where the stakeholders, when I'm meeting them, as we do at like stakeholder kickoff meetings, and they will raise their hand, you know, as I'm listening and the leader is standing up and presenting, and they'll say, are you being punished? Because sometimes people feel like coaching is a punishment, like you did something wrong and you're bad and you need to be fixed. And in this particular instance, and this is also my preference, these are high potential leaders. They had already been selected to serve together on a group. And it was just sort of a natural progression for them. Like they had already been meeting on a monthly basis in this group. And then the executives came and said, all right, we're going to integrate JB's leadership development. And we had a whole timeline that was sort of mapped out in advance where we had the initial kickoff, we had the measurement, then we had 6 months of training. That's all they had was 6 months of measurement. So it's really relatively short. But during that 6 months, I was engaging in twice monthly one-on-ones. And we had monthly group sessions, and I'll come back to that. They also had weekly check-ins where we had set up a base camp and they had to check in with each other and me on a weekly basis in writing. And then at the end, they had to present. So I gave you a little bit more than what you asked for, but you're taking me back to when it started. Was before we started, I had to have the vision for the entire thing all the way to the end. And so that was kind of a tall order to be asked, can you do group coaching, make it long-term, and plot out the entire plan before you submit it to us for our approval?
And how did stakeholder-centered coaching fit into, because it's so structured, did that give you an easy way to write that proposal, or did you have to do a lot of thinking as an instructional designer to piece something together?
Stakeholder-centered coaching, I would say, did the heavy lifting for me. So that was the skeleton for the entire experience, was to just base it off of stakeholder-centered coaching, particularly the measurement and the surveys in gathering the feedback. The only adjustment that I made to stakeholder-centered coaching was we talk about the setting of the goal based on the initial feedback. The initial feedback in this case, the survey was augmented to include questions about the environment. So I asked all of the standard questions about how is this leader doing? What are their strengths and weaknesses? But then in addition to that, I also asked, tell me about this work environment and what are the opportunities in the work environment? And they would also get feedback on that. So they would set two goals, one for the environment that they were managing and one for themselves as a leader. And what that also allowed for them to do was once they had the data and they could declare a goal, like this is what the environment is asking out of me, and this is how I want to enhance the effectiveness of the environment, they could then enlist the people working in that environment to participate in the addressing of that goal. And so it let them delegate when they would talk about, here's the environmental goal, here's how I'm making progress on it every month, and here are the assistant managers or employees who want to participate, who want to do things to make things better with regard to this goal. And that also enhanced their leadership abilities as well.
Okay, to orient myself, you've got a team of six. It sounds like they're running different functions. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. All in very different areas.
So you've got this team of six, all running different functions. Each person has their own growth area. And then they pick one for the environment that their respective teams now contribute to. So while you're coaching, talking about your ability to replicate yourself and be in multiple places at once, you're coaching these six and they're ultimately coaching their team, bringing everyone along to really scale your impact. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yeah, that's a great way to put it. And in a subtle way, even though we may not call it out in that regard, they're learning how to delegate things to the people reporting to them.
That's really cool. Well, what did these environmental goals sound like? You know, how were they articulated from the leaders?
Environmental goals typically addressed things with regard to employee engagement employee satisfaction, morale would be included in environmental goals. But sometimes they would also identify an initiative. So we need to take care of this big initiative in the 6 months. Sometimes those initiatives had already been identified before the coaching started, and they would just sort of fold that in. Like, we already have this goal set for our group. I would like to make it our I would like to make that our environmental goal so that we can now put measurement parameters around it. And we'll now get, you know, you're basically doing the work for us because you're going to be gathering the data that tells us whether or not it's working. So that then became my job. Is this initiative moving in the right direction? And we could also set other measurement parameters around it if they wanted to, but they would take care of those measurements. My measurements was just around the coaching.
And the stakeholders in the teams, were they completely gung-ho, hey, we're all going to get on board with this, or was there some massaging or convincing needed?
I love that question as well for this reason. Sometimes you do have people who are gung-ho. When they come to the stakeholder kickoff meeting, and they're like, yeah, you have my support. I'll go wherever you want me to go. I will be a, you know, full-throated participating stakeholder. I also make sure, and you know this very well, you can't have 100% fans in the room. You need the skeptics to be there as well. And I invite the skeptics to participate. And in many coaching conversations, we would talk about, how do we win this person over? What remains? Maybe this person is a skeptic to the very end. And maybe that says something more about them as a stakeholder than it says about you as a leader. But we still try. So yes, we have the full mix of everyone in the room, because we can't just play to the fans. We have to play to the skeptics as well.
Can I share with you what I love to do with skeptics? Because these are my friends. These are the people who will give you the most honest, brutal, constructive feedback. I invite them to play the role of the skeptic. I'll take them aside and say, you know, I can tell that you've got a very keen eye on this situation. I can see some of the people in this room, rightfully so, are very excited by the new shiny thing we're doing. What I really need is someone on my team who's going to look at this as neutrally as possible. And I think I can trust you for that. Would you be willing to be the person who's going to help me filter through the feedback that we're getting and just tell me the honest truth? Can I count on you to give me the ugly side of things that other people might not tell me? And when I do this, those skeptics feel empowered. They feel recognized for their, you know, we call it play the role of the professional skeptic. And they feel empowered, and they're generally, this is not a magic bullet, generally they're willing to come along for the ride.
I completely agree with that assessment. And I would say that over time, what the leader is doing is training people to be more effective at giving feedback, because both the stakeholders and the leader get tired of, oh, here's what you're doing well. Can you think of anything where I need to improve? No, can't think of anything this month. Well, that might be true the first month, but by the second month and the third month and the fourth month, they are now looking for, oh, I remember this specific day, this specific moment. I wanted to give you this feedback that this is what you did. Here's how it made me feel. This was the impact to the environment around us. Here's what I think you could do differently. You're training them not only to communicate the feedback in the moment when it's gathered, but also to be looking at all the moments in between to find the feedback, to find that moment like, oh, you did this, great job. Here's why it was effective for me. They get more articulate at sharing feedback. It makes the whole team improve.
I'd love to ask you, as I know you're very well educated, very deep in research, and I know you're doing doctoral level research right now on the topic of trust, which is an area that we do have to win with these skeptics. What's your approach for building trust in these teams when you're coming into a totally new environment, working with what's going to be the most critical leaders in this organization moving forward? How do you build trust amongst those teams?
I'm going to come back to that. I want to back up just a little bit and sort of set more context for what led me to be interested in studying trust. In my work as a coach, and particularly working with high potential leaders, we would regularly get the feedback from the stakeholders, I just want to work with a leader who I can trust. And when we would unpack that and we would sort of understand a little bit more, like, why are they saying this? What are they looking for? When we would write the goals, I would always break it into two parts. I will engage in these behaviors in order to affect this outcome. And over time, what I noticed was they would always engage in, could be delegating, could be communicating, it could be sharing decision-making authority, could be whatever behavior it was, but they always came back to, in order to build trust with my team. The word trust started coming up in goal setting over and over and over, because that's what the stakeholders were asking for. So with that in mind, as I approached my doctoral studies, I thought, I want to dig into this and really study it from an academic point of view. And so what I have done in the whole month, this whole past month, was I conducted my qualitative interviews, asked questions about what were the critical incidents that contributed to the development of trust in a senior leader and a supervisory leader? What were the critical incidents that contributed to distrust in a senior leader and a supervisory leader? And I have learned a lot of things, some things that even surprised me about trust building. And so I can't share all of it in the amount of time that we have today.
What a cliffhanger, JV. How are you going to leave us that way?
I will share some of it. And this is what's on my mind today. If you want to build trust as a leader, you have this little moment in time where there is a change that's afoot. So, for example, a new leader is promoted to manage an existing team. That is a change for everybody, both the new leader and the team. Akin to that, you can also be an existing leader with an existing team, and you have somebody new on your team who is hired into a new position. Because this is a brand new relationship, whenever you have a brand new relationship, you have this narrow window of time during which you can build trust. And in general, for supervisory leaders, it's about 90 days. And within that 90 days, if you have an intentional plan to build trust with your employees, you can do it. And if you don't do it in those 90 days, you probably can't do it after that. But as a senior leader, you don't just have 90 days, you have 6 months. You could have 12 months. You could have 18 months during which you can build trust with your indirect reports, the people who report to the leaders who report to you. So many employees have no expectation that they should trust or distrust their senior leader, because particularly with young people who are new in their career, senior leader's not even on their radar yet. They have a relationship with their boss and that's it. But if they are ambitious, if they want to stay with the organization, if they want to move into new roles, they start paying attention to senior leaders and they start paying attention to whether or not those senior leaders are trustworthy. And with that in mind, senior leaders also need to have an intentional plan to build trust with their indirect reports.
Fascinating research. I'm looking forward to receiving a copy of your dissertation, if and when you're willing to share. One more question on the topic of trust. If I'm in the audience today and I need to build trust with my team, I'm getting appointed to a new position, or I just want to build better cohesive relationships with my indirect reports as a senior leader, what are some of the key aspects that should be in my intentionality plan for building trust with my people?
Everyone in a leadership role needs to know how to do this with every single one of their employees. So as I just mentioned, if it's a brand new relationship, you can be intentional about doing it and build it into your calendar. Even if these relationships are old, you can sort of refresh the trust in these ways. Employees have an expectation, number one, that you know how to do your job. Now, if you are wrong fit, I don't know if I can help you. But if you are right fit for your job, in other words, you have the functional expertise to do your job, make sure that your employees see that, because that's fundamental to their ability to trust in you. I have lots of stories in my research about people recognizing, like, this person was not right fit for their role. They didn't have the functional expertise. They kept asking other people to do things for them because they clearly couldn't do them on their own. And if you're wrong fit, find the role where you're right fit. I don't know how to say it any other way than that. But beyond that, once you're right fit, to be intentional about building trust, take an interest in people on a personal level. So I do this all the time, particularly in training. I do it whenever I'm bringing new groups of people who they might be strangers to each other at the beginning. They will be less than strangers at the end because we will build in time for them to talk about who they are, where they're from, what's important to them, talk about things that have happened in their lives. Particularly, I mean, I also work this into the work I do with narrative communication. If you can tell a story about what you're good at and something you're proud of, that reveals something about your values. If you can tell a story about how you overcame adversity, and every single one of us on planet Earth has had to overcome adversity at some point in our lives, if you can articulate that and bond with someone else about, you know, what adversity did you face and how did you overcome it, that is also a way to build trust. Because what you're finding underneath when we talk about trust, this is kind of, Brandon, this is kind of the bugaboo that's inside of trust, which I don't get into this a lot, but it's something that I find fascinating. And it's something that also makes people uncomfortable. So brace yourself. We're going to talk about something uncomfortable. The idea of sameness is one of the components of trust. And the reason it makes people uncomfortable, particularly my colleagues who work in diversity, equity, and inclusion, is when people talk about sameness, they tend to think first of what's the same about us on the outside. Do we have the same skin color? Are we the same gender? Do we come from the same place? Do we have the same ethnicity? These are all sort of the external things that you wear on your outside that people can see. I can look at you and make a judgment about you. You are either the same as me or you're not. And based on that, I will decide whether or not I trust you, which is an unfortunate truth. Below that, we can find sameness about our experiences. We all had childhoods. We all had parents. We all had home environments. We all had communities that we grew up in. And once we talk about the things that, like I go back to, overcoming adversity, I can find a new sameness that maybe is not on the surface. And if I can help you find that sameness that lies underneath, you can now start trusting these people who you may initially may not have wanted to trust. And once we find that sort of inner sameness, we can just make the world a better place by helping people trust each other. And, you know, I would call it find our shared humanity and basic human decency. I hope that was helpful.
Absolutely incredible. Absolutely. Way more than I could have asked for. Thank you so much for that, JB. This is fascinating. Again, I'm very interested to hear how your research about trust comes out and what we as executive coaches can do. And I think you talk a lot about this on your podcast, correct?
I talk about lots of different things on my podcast, but in general, I'm looking to help leaders become more self-aware, apply tools and tips based on their own experiences, and just get better at being more influential in their environments.
Hmm. And this is Leadership Life Stories, ladies and gentlemen. Be sure to check that out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, bring me back to this particular case. So you've got these leaders, they've picked a growth area, and I know that you've got these staggered sessions. You've got something going on, you know, daily implementation, weekly check-ins, monthly sessions. Kind of give me a broad, or we've had the broad strokes. Let's dive in a little bit about what those actual sessions when you were with those leaders, what did that look like? How were you conducting it and what kind of activities were going on?
Yeah, I want to hone in on one particular aspect of these sessions. So once a month, I could meet for half a day. It was really only about 3.5 hours with a group of 6 leaders. And I did this multiple times in this particular organization. And it was very important to me to focus on 2 things in our group sessions. One was trust building, which we just talked about, building rapport and you know, being consistent in your commitments. But the other was executive presence. And so in order to build a sense of executive presence, to me, and by the way, I'll mention this because I have this book up here on my shelf. Sylvia Ann Hewlett wrote the book Executive Presence back in, I think it was 2012 or 2013, and I have referred to that work ever since. And she breaks executive presence down into three categories. One is appearance. The second aspect is communication. And the third aspect is gravitas. And the most important aspect of gravitas is confidence. So I'm thinking to myself, I actually teach this as a part of leadership and practice, which is my group coaching. And I'm thinking, how can I help people gain confidence? Well, in order to gain confidence, you have to face the things that make you unconfident. So every single month, every person participating would have to do a monthly check-in. Initially, they could sit at their seat. They had to answer the question, remind us of what your goals are. Tell us about the progress that you've made on this goals, what's working. Tell us about what the challenges are, what's not working, and where do you need advice? And they would have to prepare that in a timed presentation. So initially, they can be kind of loose and casual. You run over a little bit. I'll say, okay, wrap it up. But then we would do a little press conference, and all the other participants would get to ask one question. The person who presented has to listen to all of the questions, and then it has to give a timed response addressing the questions that have been asked. And the way that this evolves over time is, at first, it's casual. By the second session, you don't get to sit at your seat. You have to stand. By the third session, you have to stand, and I'm recording you. And by the fourth session and the fifth session, they are standing in front of the group. They are taking questions, thinking on their feet, and responding live. They haven't heard the questions in advance. And every executive needs to be able to do exactly that, be in the spotlight. It's a very uncomfortable position for many people at the beginning, but by giving them that practice and building up to it, letting them sort of, you know, take baby steps out of their comfort zone, they become executives. And I apologize if I'm jumping ahead to the results, or should I not apologize?
Tell me about the results. No, it's never, no need to apologize, JB. We are here to talk about your success story.
The results couldn't be categorized as simply, here's how the feedback on the mini surveys improved. It did improve. And I will also add, sometimes it had to go down before it came back up, which I always enjoyed. Like, hey, you actually got worse this last month. Let's work on that. But by the time they would get to the end, they would learn those lessons, they would fix those problems, and the scores would go up. But to me, the evidence of the results was the long-term implications. So the fact that in this particular organization, when I talk about the need for succession planning, all of those executives who I worked with at the beginning, who hired me, none of them work there anymore. They didn't get fired, they retired. And this is not exactly true today, because the executive team has kind of grown. But I would say this was true a year ago. Every single person on that executive team, except for one who was hired from the outside, was someone who had graduated from group coaching with me, and including the CEO. So to me, that was evidence that what we were doing was recognized as making a difference. It was appreciated. And it wasn't just the group coaching and the fact that they helped each other go through that experience together. It was that in those meetings, when we would talk about the challenges that they were facing in their environments, they got a chance to talk about the organization where they worked in ways that I couldn't even begin to prompt them. They talked about their own values. They talked about the standards that they set for themselves, the aspects of the culture that they liked, as well as the aspects that they didn't like. And over time, because they were sort of, you know, growing into themselves and their own abilities, they started to articulate a vision for what they wanted the organization to look like in the future. And that's when I knew we were building future executives.
Well, I know that you're such a vivacious learner. As you reflect on this engagement, what would you say that you learned from it?
Wow, Brandon, what did I learn from it? Okay. Thanks for the challenging questions today. I learned how to be a better coach. I mean, I already knew that I love being in a learning environment. I like creating an experience where I get to see somebody else sort of go through those hard, adverse moments and come out better and stronger, and to also share with them, here's the proof that you are getting better. I have hard evidence saying you are becoming more effective as a leader, and I am happy for you. That is what gives me satisfaction. But to also see, you know, when you go back to the term humility, to know that I'm getting better as a coach, I'm not perfect. I make mistakes just like everyone else does. And I'll add this as an anecdote. This is also true in the context of trust building. There are times as coaches where we have to face adverse moments as well. And it's not just sharing the bad news in a mini survey. Sometimes it's navigating the relationships where maybe we didn't click right away. Maybe I'm still working on figuring out, how do I click with this person that I'm coaching? And I think back to a moment with one of my coaching participants where I had showed up for one of our one-on-ones. And there was an expectation that he would have completed his monthly feedback sessions with his stakeholders. And the meeting started. I sat down and he said, "Oh, sorry, I didn't have time." And in that moment, I put my hands on the arms of the chair and I stood up and I said, "Send me an email. Let me know when you're available." He's like, "Well, wait, can't we continue with the meeting today? I mean, I got some of them done, but I didn't get all of them." And I said, "You send me an email when you have all of them done, and then we'll discuss it." And then I got an email from him immediately after that saying, "Okay, we need to talk about this." So then we had our one-on-one when he was ready. And he said, "You disrespected me, and I don't like that." And that was the opening for us to have a candid conversation about expectations and fulfilling obligations. And I apologized to him. I said, "Maybe I didn't handle that in the right way in the moment, and I'm sorry, because I care about this relationship." And Brandon, what I can tell you is, in the moment when you make an apology and you sort of clear the air and you acknowledge, "I care about this relationship, that is my priority with you," we can have moments of distrust. We can have moments where trust is breached. As long as we engage in trust repair, then the trust becomes even stronger. And so that's what I'm trying to work on with everybody, that maybe we don't click right away. Maybe we actually have a moment of distrust. I'm willing to push through that with you and figure out, what's it going to take to make this work, because I care about your success.
Beautiful. Wow. I have goosebumps, JB. I really appreciate you sharing that. Thinking to our audience, I imagine that somewhere out there right now, there's a coach who is focusing on trust, or there is an organization with a largely retiring leadership team. What advice would you have for people in light of your learnings from this engagement?
I would invite any organizational leader, like if you are in a strategic level position, think about the future of your organization beyond just up to the day that you retire, and consider what your legacy is going to be in terms of preparing the next generation of leaders. And take steps to make sure that all of the hard work that you put into this organization continues after you're gone, by preparing those leaders to act and uphold the standards that you have already set.
Thank you so much, JB. If I am a coach, if I am a leader or an organization wanting to know more about coaching, more about you, follow your story, how can people get in touch with you? How can people learn more?
You can connect with me on LinkedIn. Just type in JB Adams or Adams Learning. That's actually my LinkedIn, is Adams Learning. My website is adamslearning.com. My email address is jb@adamslearning.com. And you can catch my podcasts, which include Leadership Life Stories, Karma Connections, which is associated with my business school where I teach. And I'll be launching a new podcast in the coming year that's going to be called Word Gets Around, which will focus on leadership, leader communication, and trust building.
JB Adams shared his innovative approach to group coaching for leadership development. Through JB's guidance, leaders are prepared for the challenges of tomorrow, highlighting the importance of trust, group dynamics, and stakeholder feedback. We hope this episode inspires you to consider group coaching
in your leadership development initiatives. Remember, all the case studies of this season are available for download at mgscc.net/case-studies. The link can also be found in the episode description. And if you'd like to better understand the foundations of leveraging stakeholders and measuring results in your coaching, then join the free training program, Foundations of Stakeholder-Centered Coaching, where we share the philosophies and frameworks that guarantee improved leadership effectiveness in 12 months or less. You can register for the free course at mgscc.net/foundations-course. Until next time, this has been another episode of Conversations with Coaches by Stakeholder-Centered Coaching, where we believe everyone deserves a stakeholder-centered leader. Thank you for joining the conversation, and stay tuned for more stories of leadership transformation.